I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Hello, and welcome to another Damn Fine Espresso. This episode, we're talking about what has probably been the cinematic phenomenon of 2023, Barbenheimer, the concurrent release of Greta Gerwig's Barbie and Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. And with me to discuss all things pink and atomic is Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
I mean, let's start with the big question. Did you get Barbenheimer fever?
No, but I definitely felt it. It was basically going around. It was like another one of those, if you know, pandemics that everyone talks about, which is a surprise because in Switzerland, I think we're not that much into all these big media or cultural hypes for whatever reason. But I mean, it's definitely been very hypey around here. We went to the cinema and it was full, more so than it was for the last Bond movie. And I've not seen that in years, really. How about you?
I mean, very, very sort of similar that cinema for both films was completely sold out, and had the phenomena that I've not seen in a long time of turning up at the cinema and they'd almost just produced a sign, almost like a handwritten sign, which basically was saying everything's sold out.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bother trying to pop in. And they were showing both Barbie and Oppenheimer, and just both, all the showings we've got are sold out. And I don't remember seeing that before.
Mm-hmm.
For a long, long time, simply because I think cinemas, there's more screens, but I think they're more prepared for the big summer films, so they tend to make sure that they've got screen space for them.
Mm-hmm.
And to see it sort of absolutely like wall-to-wall sold-out screenings was quite fun, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just for the good of cinema, it seemed great to see cinemas doing well.
Yep, no, that's absolutely the case. I mean, I have to admit, I feel a bit uncomfortable these days if the cinema is just jam-packed. But for the cinemas, it was definitely really, really nice. And also surprising audiences. I mean, especially with Barbie, for instance, we saw entire groups of just guys. And that's not something I expected.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very broad church, I think. A broader church for both films, mm-hmm. I think. When I sort of, like, in packed houses, sort of looking around, that you sort of didn't get the impression, oh, well, this is just skewing completely to one single demographic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think there was definitely sort of like a broad cross-section of the population, which I think the hype probably helped create, that people were going to see these films who probably wouldn't go see the films, and that was just because of the media event.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Now, regardless of what we personally thought of the two films, do you understand why it's these two films that draw so much of an audience?
I mean, ultimately, it's inexplicable, but I do think it's interesting that it was at the turn of the year that I first started seeing previews of 2023, making note of the fact that these two films were scheduled for the same date. That already was sort of raising a little eyebrow, that you had these two quite big budget films, seemingly so different, coming out on the same day. And I do know that there was talk at some point in early 2023 that Oppenheimer would move, that Oppenheimer would sort of find another date to not be maybe overtaken with all the Barbie hype.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember seeing it as sort of like, oh, this is something interesting. This is like an interesting curio, but certainly not something that you felt would develop the sort of life that it created and it took on, this phenomenon. I mean, it seemed like quite a funny double bill. I think Christopher Nolan is famous enough, and clearly Barbie is famous enough, that it would have some traction in the general population that these films were coming out. And then I think it was quite fun to link them to. I mean, one of the things that I think was most exciting is, I don't think this was a media-created phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was a phenomenon that sort of came from people who saw the two films coming together, thought that was fun, and decided that they might go see them. And I think the media felt it was being a little bit more reactive.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And that was quite fun, that there wasn't someone very cynical in January this year saying, right, this day we will market it as Barbenheimer. It sort of created its own thing. And that sort of spontaneous cultural creation was quite fun to feel that you were part of it.
Mm-hmm. It kind of almost feels like an internet meme having left the internet, Tron fashion-like, and usually if you've got a meme and it's the media that pick up on it and the corporations, that's when a meme basically dies, when it basically is taken behind the woodshed and shot. And in this case, it really, the meme did go viral in the real world in a way that I've really not ever seen. Did you actually go full Barbenheimer? Did you watch them both in sequence on the same day?
No, I chickened out of doing that simply because I realized they were both long films. And also, sometimes if you watch a big film and then you sort of need time to process it afterwards. So I did see them both on opening weekend. Mm-hmm. How about you? Did you manage the full Barbenheimer?
No, I didn't really want to, because I have to say that if I actually enjoy a film, I'm in the world of that film very much so. And then watching something else, even if it's not that much of a contrast, doesn't really work for me, because either I'm pulled out of the mood of the first film and I don't want that, or I'm not pulled out and then it ruins the second film for me. So yeah, I thought that basically I'm basically not the audience for the full Barbenheimer. But we did watch them both basically about a week apart, and you know, also thought, okay, this is now the second week, there's not going to be that many people at the audio at the cinema, but still, yeah, jam-packed. And it's I think here, at least in Switzerland, Oppenheimer has taken off even a bit more than Barbie, but that might have just been the individual days when we went.
Which order did you do it in? Was it Barbie first and then an Oppenheimer chaser?
No, basically we had dinner with vegetables first, so Oppenheimer, and then we had dessert the week after.
Yeah. No, I did Barbie opening night because I think, you know, slightly caught up in the hype. I thought I want to see it. Mm-hmm. I loved the first trailer, the sort of 2001 parody trailer. And then I bitterly regretted watching the next one that kind of said, oh, part of the plot is Barbie traveling to the real world. And I didn't know that up until that point with the trailer. And at that point, I sort of vowed, okay, I don't want to know what happens in Barbie. I kind of want to be surprised by it. And so I sort of very much thought, well, I'm not going to watch any other promotional material, but also I'm going to go opening night because it'll be all over the internet very quickly if there's anything huge or any big surprises. So that I did opening night, and then, which was the Friday night, and then Monday night I did sort of Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm. Was that one spoiled for you? Did you find out on the internet that actually he goes and, oh no, creates the atomic bomb?
Yeah, so the trailers gave it a little bit away then. So which did you prefer? Did you have a preferred film?
Okay, that is a difficult question, because in some ways my reaction to both was quite similar. I liked them both. I liked them a lot. I think they're both good films. I'm glad I saw them at the cinema. But I think both were not ruined, but basically my liking of them was diminished a bit by having read too much, and especially having read too many superlative reviews and reactions beforehand. So I liked them both, but neither fully convinced me. Of course, the specifics are very different between the two films, but I would say that with both of them, you know, if I were to kind of give them school grades, I would probably say with both of them B+, for slightly different reasons, but in similar ways. How about you?
I think almost exactly the same reaction. I was sort of thinking, and I had in my notes that I would give both films a solid 3 out of 5. Mm-hmm. They were sort of enjoyable films. Neither of them sort of really felt like they shattered or shook the genre, which, given sort of the scale of the phenomenon, you kind of might think that would be, with hindsight, people looking back on all the hype must have thought, well, they must have been two of the most earth-shattering films, and they were just solidly enjoyable, and with caveats. I think probably I would say I have more caveats with Oppenheimer, which I don't know whether is just like the nature of the type of film, or, you know, you're more likely to spot stuff you'll be critical of in a film that wants to be taken seriously, as opposed to a film that is clearly being a bit silly. But I was very glad I saw Oppenheimer in the cinema, because I think its greatest strengths benefit from seeing it on a huge screen. I do remember when I was sitting watching Oppenheimer, there was a couple of moments. I think it suffers very much from what feels like lazy biopic dialogue disease. There's a lot of like single lines that you only ever get in biopics because they have to convey a huge amount of information. So, you know, they will introduce someone to make sure you know exactly who they are, but in the most convoluted way possible. And I also think Florence Pugh seems to have got the short end of the stick with the film. I think that character, I couldn't quite understand what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there these sort of factors as you're watching it, thinking, ah, I'm not too, these aren't great, but they're not, that they are criticisms of a good film rather than they sort of sink the film completely.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. I think with Christopher Nolan, I have to say that I like him best when he says nothing at all, to some extent, by which I mean that his strength really lies in the script and the actors delivering the scripts. His strengths are mostly where he delivers themes, or perhaps less than themes, vibes, tone in images.
Mm.
And I think the moment that his characters start talking, you sometimes have dialogues that work, that are effective, but they also tend to be very on the nose. And I think the same is true here with Oppenheimer, that sometimes it feels like whatever themes he has, he spells them out in dialogue. And I think spelling out themes works in the rarest of cases. And I think for me, that combines with the length. I do think that it's not that I thought that the film felt too long, but I felt that it would have been more effective at perhaps half an hour less long.
Yeah, I sort of feel that. I mean, that was partly for me discovering that the IMAX cinema that I was seeing it in, it wasn't generous with legroom. Mm-hmm. So it had an amazingly giant screen. And so a 3-hour film was sort of pushing it 2.5 hours in. I was wishing that it was a 2.5 hour film. But yeah, I think that's right. I think that the sort of script weakness is common with a lot of Nolan stuff. And I think he does seem to have moments where he does something, because he does something that's a bit stupid or maybe silly is better, or simplistically silly. It sort of stands out more because the tone and the mood is so serious.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember watching Tenet, and I think the moment Kenneth Branagh's East European bad guy turns up in that, and he would probably not pass the audition for a Bond film playing it like he does in that film. I mean, his voice is such a cliche, it's just absurd. And so suddenly it's so much harder to take the film seriously because there's this just badly accented like cliche of a villain. And so I sort of mentioned some of the moments. Another moment in Oppenheimer that sort of did the same effect to me was the way that Einstein sort of kept turning up as this like twinkly Santa figure to impart a couple of dollops of wisdom. And it was just sort of like, I want a bit more of the complexity of these people. I mean, maybe that's unrealistic, but that was certainly, I think near the end, there's a scene where sort of a car pulls away and there's Einstein standing there and he sort of delivers a twinkly homily. And I was just like, this is just, what are you doing? Like, if you want this film to be serious, you can't make it like the Einstein Clause film and have him come in. And they were just moments rather than something that sort of fundamentally flawed to the film. But yeah, I think they stand out more in Nolan because he does go for the seriousness so much.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. By the way, in brackets, I think the Einstein Clause should absolutely be the Christmas movie of this year. But yeah, no, I think if I think back to the early Nolan films, I think they're the ones of his that I like most because they are not yet weighed down with this expectation of being deep and important to the same extent. And if you look at something like Memento, for instance, which I think is also flawed, but it has a lightness, it has a sense of fun. And I think that is something that the later films very often don't have because they have a self-importance which doesn't serve them well. And I think that's definitely there to some extent with Oppenheimer. I think what perhaps also doesn't help is, I mean, there's an entire plot strand that's distributed throughout the film or sprinkled around the film with Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Louis Strauss. And I think I really like Robert Downey Jr.'s performance in the film. I think it's a very watchable performance. He's really enjoyable, and it's also nice to see him, you know, as someone else in Iron Man for a change. But at the same time, especially since the last half hour of the film focuses so much on that storyline, I don't quite see its thematic relevance, because in the end, the film wants to be about, you know, this whole, what have I done? You know, I am become Death, the destroyer of worlds. And that story is more like kind of second-rate Amadeus with a kind of bald-headed Salieri type.
Yeah, no, it definitely sort of, it goes into that sort of final act of the film. And by a similar token, although they sort of, like you said, they sort of sprinkle elements of it through it, I still felt like when we hit it as the last act, that it kind of came out of nowhere. It felt a little bit like, well, hang on, why is he so hostile to Oppenheimer? It didn't. I mean, historically, you could maybe research it, and if you historically research it, there's a lot to suggest it wasn't so pettily vindictive in the way it's sort of presented in the film. But it also, it sort of felt like it came out of nowhere, and suddenly this film about the atomic bomb and Oppenheimer maybe coming into trouble with the authorities afterwards, suddenly, yeah, they sort of put another layer on top of that straight from Amadeus, and I was very much thinking, well, where has this come from? It doesn't feel like it's built into what I've seen before, mm-hmm. which may be that I miss stuff on a first viewing because, you know, you're sort of blown away by it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think another thing, and this is weirdly sort of listing what Oppenheimer isn't in some respects, but I did see a stage play on Oppenheimer, I think in around 2015. And one of the things that the stage play did incredibly well, I mean, it almost had, you could call them musical numbers, but what they presented on the stage really explained the science mm-hmm. as to what was going on visually. They did an amazing job of doing that. So what it was that Oppenheimer, the route they went down, how atomic explosions work, what causes it, why is there radiation to it, all of that was sort of explained in this amazing visual way on stage. And I think I did go into Oppenheimer thinking, well, clearly, if you're making this film, you'd want to do something similar. We will have amazing visuals that really show us the intensity of the science here. And it tended to be more sort of abstract images that sort of cut into certain scenes, especially near the beginning, and they sort of disappear for quite a bit of the film. But you never had the sort of point of just going, this is actually what we're doing. This is the science. This is what is happening. Which, bizarrely, I guess, you know, it's not really a criticism in the sense that clearly that wasn't the film he ever wanted to make. But I was surprised going in expecting that to be in the film. That wasn't in there at all.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that, you know, I enjoyed it. It's one of those sort of pluses when you enjoy a film, but what you talk about afterwards is its weaknesses. Because the strengths are so self-evident. The strength, I think, is a central performance. I think it's the sort of visual scale of it. It's hard to talk about it. So I think in the end, you're sort of doomed to pick at the flaws. Which I think that's almost the reverse is true, to sort of move on to Barbie. That because of its silliness, the bits that, you know, are maybe don't quite work, don't stand out in the same way. That attempts at maybe seriousness didn't feel quite as jarring as I found the silliness in Oppenheimer.
Yeah, Barbie is a weird one because I think it's... there's a lot of it that I enjoy in theory. In practice, I didn't quite think it all worked. And for me, that's mostly that. I mean, it's one thing, it's a comedy, and it's a very funny comedy at times. It's also a film about themes of feminism, about gender roles, gender stereotypes. And a lot of those themes and what it says about those themes, I agree with. I'm not sure it always manages to put those two things together with the story and make them all work. Sometimes it feels like, okay, now here's a bit where the story takes a backseat. Here's a bit where the characters take a backseat. And you've got that in all films. But I think in this one, I found it jarring because it felt at times like, almost like, I don't know, Greta Gerwig pushed the pause button and says, and now we'll have a speech about the themes and we'll spell them out very explicitly. And the thing is, I sat there agreeing with a lot of what was said, but I felt like, couldn't you have done this while still telling the story and serving the characters?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it is always an issue with a comedy. If you try and have a comedy about a thing, that's quite hard to do. But I quite liked how integrated I felt it was into the film.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, there was an element to which it did feel like it came from the characters. And to some extent, in many instances, it almost felt slightly depoliticized in the sense that it didn't feel to me like it was having a political moment. It was sort of delivering a gag that made sense for that character, and that if someone was to say, oh, I'm just being lectured here, I think there's a turnaround to say, well, no, if you were Barbie and you were on a beach, there is almost a comedy reaction in, you know, how you would feel, that the her unease is kind of played as it would do in an 80s comedy. There's a joke there, even though underlying the joke is obviously there's a point to the film. And I think it actually integrated that quite well, that, you know, Ken's turn to the dark side and his redoing of Barbie Land. I mean, that still, it ticked a lot of boxes that you'd go with, just that's what silly comedies do. And it sort of worked on that level, even if sort of underneath it there was a message, but also underneath it there was just some very good gags. I think so. The references to The Godfather and the reference to Pavement, there were little asides in there that I just thought, I did not expect those in the film. I did not expect it to go there, and that they got, I think, the biggest laugh from me in the cinema.
I would definitely say that, you know, where it worked best for me and most consistently was in its comedy. I mean, I expected it to be funny. I didn't expect it to be quite as witty and as clever. And even when it's being dumb, it's a clever kind of dumb, which I really enjoy. I think what perhaps bothered me a tiny bit, and that's also because, you know, I'm not that much into pure comedies. At times it felt a bit like a 2-hour episode of Saturday Night Live, you know, basically sketches on a theme stringed together. But what I kind of missed, you know, there was a lot of comparison with, for instance, the Lego Movie. And I think the Lego Movie does some things as well, some things worse. But I think the Lego Movie is better at having a bit of a, sorry, here's a German word for you, listen out for the italics, Spannungsbogen. And, you know, that really, there's a kind of arc there, a story arc, a character arc. And this one felt a bit flatter in a way, flatter in the sense that really, like, it prioritized the individual kind of thematic sketches at times. And they were very funny sketches. I mean, very funny jokes. But perhaps also at times I felt like, you know, take some of those out and focus on other things. Like, for instance, the whole storyline with the Will Ferrell character, the CEO of Mattel, which was also funny jokes. But as characters, I didn't care about them.
I was just, when you were mentioning that about what was obviously serving a sketch rather than the film, I was just going to mention the whole sort of journey to Mattel, because I think there is an underlying problem if you have the real world that Barbie's meant to go to. And I think if you want the sort of story of the woman who ended up, you know, is revealed that she's the woman who played with this Barbie in the real world, that if you want that to land, the real world has to present itself as being recognizably real. And I think the problem when they go to Mattel is you suddenly have this absurdist world akin to Barbie Land.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly you're not looking at the story where there is Barbie Land and then you travel to the real world. You're looking at something that is just, oh, this is a collection of silly worlds. And I think that definitely felt like something where, for the sake of the sketch, for the sake of these funny moments, they were to some extent abandoning what could have been a setup that would have been able to make a stronger point.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely, I think there was a few times that desire for, I agree with you, that desire for sort of sketches, the desire to land a scene that would be funny in itself, sort of meant that it didn't have quite the overall structure that you'd sort of want from a great film. But I think the fact that it's a comedy, and I don't know whether I'm just conditioned to comedies to just view them as being quite bitty and fragmented. I mean, if I look at sort of a lot of my favorite comedies, something like This Is Spinal Tap, I mean, there's not a story there. You're looking at sketches. And I think, you know, that if it goes down that route, then I think you just have to go, well, are the sketches good enough? And I think in this film that they are.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that. I think because of that, though, I was surprised. I found especially Margot Robbie very poignant at times almost. You know, she takes a character that by definition is plastic, that by definition is one-dimensional, and then extends that by means of jokes at first. But you really get the impression that they are working on around a character that still works with the jokes. And I think that's where it worked best for me. Ken is funny throughout and he makes a point throughout, but he definitely never gains more than perhaps half an additional dimension. And that was okay, but I think there was a bit of a gap there between the Barbie character as presented by Robbie and perhaps the Ken character by Gosling. To some extent, it felt like they ended up almost in two different films, which was okay for me, but I think it could have perhaps been done even a bit more neatly.
Yeah, I think it is interesting that sort of story that Ken has. And I will admit there were moments when Alan kept being mentioned that sort of threw me out. Like everyone I went with, I occasionally got looks whenever anything was said about Alan. And it was just like, yeah, no, you know, It's a comedy name, I accept that. But I think in terms of the central narrative, I think it's sort of defensible in the sense that Barbie is the one that's going to go somewhere in the Barbie film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was something I liked about that Ken doesn't really go somewhere. And I don't know whether you want to go completely meta and saying, well, Ken basically has the role that women have had in, you know, male-led films mm-hmm. since forever, right? Like, yeah, you're noticing that he doesn't have it now. Well, congratulations, like, women in films have not had it for decades. So I think it kind of worked on the level of, you know, the film's called Barbie, and I think even posters were very much, look, he is just Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is part of the joke, is that he can never go beyond a certain level, because that's almost built into the idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was extra sort of bonus comedy points when they sort of revealed discontinued Kens, like the sugar daddy Ken and the sort of discontinued versions of Barbie.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, they're sort of presented in there and you realize they're real, but you do have to do some post film Googling to look at the sheer horror of some mm-hmm. of them. And again, that sort of felt like quite fun comedy at the time that then also afterwards has a point that somebody somewhere greenlit sugar daddy Ken or a Barbie whose bust would grow when you raised her arm. These were actual things that happened, and
exactly.
I think it was fun to sort of put them in the film to just have that moment of like, what? Like, you know, this is the world of dolls and marketing that this film is. You know, this is where it comes from, but I think it's having its cake and eating it a little bit by also satirizing it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I have to say that at times I was really surprised that Mattel ever said, okay, let's go with this, because I think Mattel as a company and what it produced, the whole world of Barbie and all of these dolls, comes across as funny, almost to the point of being scary, where you, as you say, you think, what on earth were they thinking? Or if they weren't thinking, what on earth were they smoking?
I mean, what is especially striking is that I've sort of been reading since, and Greta Gerwig sort of eventually got the job. But looking at people that also that they did invite in to pitch for the film, the director Anna Billar of The Love Witch was invited in to pitch a version of Barbie that obviously didn't get made. But I think the fact that Mattel Studios were saying, you know, let's get the woman who made The Love Witch in, because she might be able to deliver a Barbie film that we could work with. It is quite interesting that they, I think quite early on, probably felt we need to do something, you know, akin maybe to the Lego movie. We want to do something that doesn't just feel like an advert, that people will think, oh, this is knowing, this is sarcastic, but also, hey, it's still us, aren't we cool? That does seem to have been built into the desire to make a Barbie movie. Which I think is quite interesting, because I imagine there's a lot of people like who, you know, the Michael Bays of this world, who would have been happy to say, look, I've got a Barbie film that I think would be brilliant, and give me the money and I'll give you this hot Zack Snyder action fest with Barbie in it. But it looks like very early on that was like, well, who are interesting women who work in film? Let's see what they pitch. And obviously, Greta Gerwig's pitch is the one that got made. But I think it's interesting that they were, it seems from quite an early stage in the development of this, they were exploring quite interesting avenues.
Which obviously makes me think now, you know, what would Christopher Nolan's Barbie look like? It would be much less pink, obviously, and you'd have Kenneth Branagh as Ken, accented Ken.
Yes, yes. And actually, it would be Christopher Nolan, so Barbie would be in it for about 3 minutes.
Exactly.
Like, she'd be naked in it for 3 minutes, and then we'd just go back to Ken angsting about the universe all over again. But conversely, Greta Gerwig's Oppenheimer would probably be a more interesting film in some respects. I think Florence Pugh wouldn't quite be so wasted if she was at the helm.
Yeah, it would be kind of Oppenheimer in high school, kind of Lady Bird-like.
And I mean, just in terms of both films, I sort of mulling over the content of both, the one thing I think is why I'm sort of very happy that they sort of were made and we had this event, is that I think both of them are excellent films that an intelligent 12-year-old would find very adult. And I don't mean that as an insult. I, you know, that's not a genre that's sort of catered for, that films are either too childish or they're made in such a way that they are slightly exclusionary. And, you know, an intelligent 12-year-old will get a huge amount from both films, I think. And I think they won't feel condescended to. I think they will feel challenged. And I think they will enjoy it. And, you know, that feels like I'm damning it with faint praise, but sometimes I think it's far too easy to go all overboard on seriousness or sort of cynicism and to actually say, no, there's a broader story to be told that I want to have a broad appeal. And I think both of them land in definitely that area. I know their sort of cinematic ratings might not mean that many 12-year-olds get to see it, but I absolutely know that for both of them, if I was in that sort of age group, I would have felt both films were amazing and sophisticated and adult. And I think that's a perk for both of them.
Mm-hmm. Kind of makes me think back to when I was 12 and went to see The Name of the Rose at the cinema. And definitely as a 12-year-old, I found it very educational in so many ways. But yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, this will sound like I'm jaded and perhaps cynical, but I also don't mean it like that. I think thinking back 20, 30 years ago, I think back then, films like Oppenheimer and Barbie would have been good films, but they wouldn't have stood out to the same extent. And I think they stand out now because we've had a glut of superhero movies and very little kind of Hollywood ambition over the last 10, 20 years. And I think both of these films, they're ambitious. Both of them have ideas. Both of them have a level of craftsmanship and also a kind of individual voice that has become rare in Hollywood over these years. And I think in that respect, they stand out because they do go against the grain. And I do appreciate that definitely in the year 2023. I think it's very necessary to have these films that have much more of a voice that doesn't feel corporate, and that I definitely appreciate.
Definitely. And I think the other thing that's quite interesting, although it might herald not the greatest of developments, is when you sort of mentioned the sort of memes that came about this, that they were inventive and fun. And I think it's sort of quite interesting to be in a situation where there was so many memes, there was so much internet on a product that hadn't been released yet.
Mm-hmm.
Normally a meme is sort of like, we're going to reference something that people recognize. Oh, you saw this, so you're going to get this reference. And to have something that said, oh, you enjoy this meme, well, it's backed by a film. And then that felt sort of quite sort of unique, the scale of everything sort of in the popular consciousness that related to a film that sort of then made people more inclined to see it. I think Barbie would have been a huge film anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I do think Oppenheimer has benefited from the sort of, you know, a rising tide raises all ships, but like the counter-programming element of it, the sort of it then getting attached to Barbie as like, look at this very different film. I think has done it a huge favor. I think that's really boosted it in the public imagination. And so I think its box office is partly stemming from that, the scale of the meme.
Mm-hmm.
That it just sort of, I think if this had come out on its own, it would have had the same sort of impact as a Dunkirk, maybe, you know, the sort of people would have seen it. It would have been well regarded, but there wouldn't, I don't think, have been a huge level of excitement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
And that excitement comes, I think, from having memes that remind everyone it exists and that they haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me think that there will be a hell of a lot of people in Hollywood who are going, well, this is how we can market films in the future. Yeah. You know, and then I think a level of cynicism, and then they'll be trying to create. I've no doubt that they're looking at summer 2024 and trying to think, well, what films look quite different that we might try something similar again. I think there's definitely going to be a push towards something like that to try and market films, which, you know, conversely, understandable because it worked. And, you know, if it gets people in cinemas, then I'm quite happy to live with it. And no matter how cynical the marketing is, if it gets people in cinemas, I think I can accept it.
Yeah, I do think, though, that basically if you try to manufacture it, chances are they're going to basically fall flat on the face.
Yeah.
There has to be a certain kind of serendipity to it. Like, for instance, at our favorite cinema, they are currently showing a series of films with Cate Blanchett. So we basically had the kind of a Barbenheimer situation there where we watched Tar and then Thor in very, you know, very close to each other, which totally works, which is totally enjoyable. So I don't know. Do you have any kind of personal Barbenheimer duos that you would want to see or that you have seen?
I mean, I realized recently that the Studio Ghibli released Grave of the Fireflies and My Neighbor Totoro as a double bill.
Oh, wow.
Which feels like it suddenly makes Barbie and Oppenheimer back to back just feels like, you know, two episodes of the same soap opera, like a mild difference. But that I think is just sort of an incredible level of whiplash. And I don't think that's ever going to be topped.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you would absolutely hope that Grave of the Fireflies was first, and then you had the soothing balm of My Neighbor Totoro afterwards. Because I think, you know, having Grave of the Fireflies second and traumatizing everyone as they left the cinema would have been quite an experience. But I think that's the double bill that I haven't quite dared watch.
Yeah.
But I've always felt it was quite remarkable when you see that it was how they initially released them in Japan.
That is almost sadistic, I have to say, especially for Studio Ghibli. It makes me think that, you know, even if you try to manufacture something similarly horrific in you know, in terms of clash, like, I don't know, Showa followed by the producers, it would not measure up.
Definitely. I mean, I do have this thing that I do try and do sometimes, which is a double bill from someone's career that is the most extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you look at someone that's had a long career. So a bit like when you were saying about Tar and Thor, but maybe someone who made a film like 40 years ago and a film now and trying to do the contrast. And I always found that quite funny because you have characters, but you have actors like Dean Stockwell, who was a child actor in 30s and 40s Hollywood. And then the stuff he was doing in the 80s, I think you can make some great whiplash through the ages double bills. But I did finally come across what I think is like the ultimate one of those, because they were showing like early British films, and especially when British studios were making to a quota, the government decided they didn't want Hollywood to overrule, you know, overrun Hollywood. So every cinema had to show a certain number of British films. And so all these studios came about that started just making, you know, 60-minute films that would meet this quota. And they had a run of these films. So they were showing, you know, the few that were good. In general, there wasn't that much that's great about them. Although Roger Corman, like, it was quite good for developing talent.
Mm-hmm.
Because literally it was like, make the film for this much money, do what you want, make it 61 minutes or whatever the minimum time for a film, and just do your own thing. And in several of them, there's this a quite young actress who plays a maid, and she plays a comedy stupid maid.
Mm-hmm.
And she obviously appeared in one, and the people said, oh, she's good at doing that role. She was quite funny. So she appears in, I think, a couple of others. You'd see her again in a completely unconnected film, this maid that was just playing comically stupid, that like she just was like slightly clueless maid, not even a main character, just would be a slight, she'd interact with the main characters, and you'd get sort of like a laugh from her slight behavior that she had this character down pat. And I thought that was quite interesting that she's in the 30s. So I thought I'd Google her. And it turns out that she retired from acting quite young and then went to New Zealand and ended up very old appearing in Peter Jackson's Brain Dead as the old woman. And I think that would be the ultimate, like, to play this sort of light 30s British comedies that she's in, and you know, that aren't that high budget, are a bit silly, maybe aren't fantastic, but to have her as the first and then go to Peter Jackson's Brain Dead, it just feels like it's got that quality of across someone's career, you'll never beat that as a double bill.
And they should really, what they should do is they should basically take two films like that, those two films, and edit them together, you know, very much Oppenheimer like and then present it at, this is actually the, you know, the biopic about this woman. Have some scenes in black and white, some in color, give it some bombastic soundtrack, and perhaps a, you know, kind of Father Christmas-like Einstein to tie it all together.
Well, that would be Peter Jackson, wouldn't it? He'd turn off as like a twinkly character. But yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, this probably feels a little bit like the future for a while of marketing will be, like, these things seem very different, but if you put them together for a meme, it looks quite fun. And I think, like you said, most, if the studios try and do it, most of them will fall flat on their face, but I think they're going to be doomed to try for a bit, because it just takes one to work, and they're going to be quids in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we'll be there to watch them.
Oh, yeah, that's always a sucker for the advertising. But excellent. Do you have any sort of final thoughts on Barbenheimer?
I'm really glad they both exist. I'm really glad I saw them both. I'm glad I saw them both at the cinema. Even if I'm not quite swept away by the hype like some other people, yeah. I mean, I keep falling for Christopher Nolan films again and again, even though I always think, yeah, but... And I'm always there for Greta Gerwig, which also means that at some point I'll have to revisit Frances Ha because I kind of bounced off that one. But yeah, no, I think it's definitely the right films for the right time in a weird way, and let's see how that develops. How about you?
I mean, I feel exactly the same as you. It's quite odd that we agreed to do this and then, you know, actually shared the same opinion on these films. So I'm glad we've managed to find 45 minutes to talk about beyond, yes, I agree with you.
Absolutely.
So, no, well, cheers for talking about all things Barbenheimer, and join us again next time for another damn fine espresso.
Bye.
Bye.